Okay. University of Detroit at that time had about 13,000 students. There probably were less than 100 black students in the school. And there really were no black organizations. There were all these sororities, which of course were all white. None of us were really interested in sororities anyway. My friend Charles Cotman had got involved with picketing Woolworths because in Detroit, the Woolworths chapter were not serving black folks in North Carolina. The student senate had started it. We'd started picketing the chapters in Detroit. While I was a junior in college, Conrad Rutkowski got the idea to set up an NAACP chapter. He was actually a political science student. I think he might have lived in Hamtramck, the Polish section of Detroit. And he had asked Harold Spaeth, who was...
Remember the year?
1961. He had asked Harold Spaeth, spelled as P-H-E-T-H, to be the moderator in NAACP. Harold Spaeth was a very bright political science teacher. I think the fact that he got involved with NAACP probably ended his political career at the University of Detroit, but he went on to become a full professor at Michigan State and actually made quite a name for himself by predicting how Supreme Court justices would vote. So Conrad Rutkowski, I guess, got Charles Cotman involved, who was the vice president. And he got myself involved. And there was kind of an outrage on the campus. Almost every student newspaper, which came out weekly, almost every week had something to the effect that why we did not need NAACP chapter on the campus. I remember Jim Broad, B-R-O-A-D, the Young Republicans, used to say that one could not legislate against racism, which was full of heart. Therefore, there was no need for an NAACP chapter involved. In fact, they even wanted to get the athletes involved to testify that they didn't need an NAACP chapter. And I went and met with the athletes, and they agreed, at least, if they would not support us, that they would not get involved at all. I remember Charles and Cobb and I were walking through the campus one day, and one of the Jesuits was very involved, the athletes, came up to us and said, there's no reason to have an NAACP chapter here. I was really shocked at the outrage on the campus, and the student senate decided to table the issue and bring it back for the next year. And so when we had the elections, I think Winifred MacArthur was elected president, and I was elected vice president. The late Daniel Newsom was the youth advisor. For the NAACP chapter, and got us involved regionally. I wound up becoming the state vice president. We met at, they had a someplace near me. I can't remember the name of the town. It was Michigan, near Illinois. They had a state meeting. It's a small town. But we got involved. And the local Detroit NAACP chapter, Abe Ulmer would have, the story was so segregated, so Abe Ulmer, and then there was an actress who used to have a TV program that we used to watch at Black Barn, the White Camellia. She was involved, and each weekend we would pick a suburb and go out and demonstrate, because black folks weren't allowed to live in the suburbs of Detroit at that time. In fact, in Dearborn, if you were caught after dark in Dearborn, you would get arrested. They, Dearborn pride themselves on not allowing black folks to live there or to be there after dark. In fact, they had a recreation park on Camp Dearborn or something, where they purposely stated you had to be a citizen of Dearborn to use this park to prevent minorities from using the park. It was around this time that I met Hank Rogers. Hank Rogers was a very brilliant student who had an engineering degree, and he was getting a master's degree. I think it was in business. I remember he was taking some courses in neurophysiology, and he went out to talk to his instructor. His instructor refused to let him in his house and actually gave him a bad grade in the class. He was very involved with NAACP and got us involved with the local chapters. There was a guy by the name of Barry Kalish who actually later went to Newark, worked with Tom Hayden, who was teaching the Barbara Junior High School students, and he got them involved in our demonstrations. Of course, for some reason, the executive secretary, Arthur Johnson, president of the tri chapters, Ed Turner, denounced Barry Kalish in the newspapers because they said, we're watching him because he's afraid he's going to be teaching isms to the young students. I guess the McCarthy period had shortly ended. In Detroit, at this time, people were getting involved in the movement. The mayor of Detroit was Mayor Cavanaugh, who actually was a graduate of the University of Detroit High School and College, and his son was actually a friend of mine, was a year ahead of me at the high school. And Lucius Tripp's brother formed a group called the Gurus. And they went down and picketed Mayor Cavanaugh, sit in Mayor Cavanaugh's office and picketed. So there was a hot spring of activity. In fact, the late Kenny Cockrell was very involved at that particular time. We would sometimes go down to Debs Hall. We would sometimes go down to Debs Hall and hear the speakers. That was the Young Socialist Workers place. And I didn't realize at the time, but later Charles Cotman was teaching UND, was teaching the FBI agent. He said he pulled this file and said every time he went down to Debs Hall to hear someone speak, which we occasionally do, they would have his name and everything.
Hey, first.
And during my senior year, after again much turmoil in the school newspapers, they actually decided to let the NAACP chapter own the campus. And so we had a big dinner celebration. I think there was a Polish congressman from Hamtramck who was there. Jackie Bond, who later became a state representative, was there. And it was kind of, we had a little celebration dinner at the school. And of course, Harold Space was denied the chairmanship of the political science department. They gave it to someone else who actually didn't even have his PhD, was working on, was planning on getting it. So Harold left that year and moved to Michigan State. In fact, Lucius and I drove up to Lansing, I think that sometime after that, to give him a plaque of Thanksgiving for his work with the NAACP chapter. And actually my getting involved in NAACP got us involved with SNCC because I remember Hank Rogers telling me Elizabeth Hirschfeld, who'd been on the Freedom Rides, the Second Freedom Rides, who had been very involved with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Meeting. She had an apartment on Oakland. And she was having a meeting. They were trying to organize people to get involved with SNCC, which is how I kind of wound up getting involved with the Friends of SNCC. But anyway, I went on and graduated from the University of Detroit, but I think I was so bitter I hadn't even planned to go to the graduation, but my mother and my Aunt Ruth had walked to the campus to go, so I did go and got my degree, although I never picked up my yearbook because I was so angry at the school. Yes, what's the...
Your contact with racism and your political involvement and your introduction to socialism, does this all shape your desire to go to med school?
No. I decided to go to medical school when I graduated from high school. Basically, I thought I was thinking about going to work in a third world country or even a socialist country. And I thought it would be a useful skill to have. And I just picked that out of random. There really, in the late 50s, early 60s, there really weren't any avenues for black folks. There were no television. Everybody was a white male. Black folks who had graduate degrees had to, in the 50s, they had to go teach in the South. They couldn't get schools in the North. In fact, a lot of the northern cities hired their first black teachers in the early 50s. In fact, your uncle was the first black teacher in Santa Monica, got hired in the early 50s. All the teachers were white. In fact, I think we just started getting black bus drivers in the 50s. The major department stores, which were busy in downtown Detroit, all the salesmen were white. The only D.L. Hudson's would hire black folks to be elevator girls to operate elevators. Hudson was the premier store in downtown Detroit. And they had to be light-skinned black women. They would wear a little brown uniform, and they would test you before you were going, well, and you got on the elevator. That was the only position. There were, even in spite of the fact that Detroit had a sizable black population, there were no black folks elected to the city council at the time. In fact, Nicholas Hood and Jackie Vaughn ran for the city council. Nicholas Hood was a minister, and the newspapers thought Jackie Vaughn was too radical. Jackie wasn't a radical, but they thought he was too radical for him. So they did a distortion campaign on him. Like, they said Jackie claimed to be 35 years old, and they went down to Alabama. Jackie was went to the same small town that Mrs. Steele was from, and they said that we got a birth certificate that says you're 45. Jackie said that was his older brother, Jackson Vaughn, that they had the birth certificate. But they did a kind of a distortion slander plan on him, which probably played a factor in his defeat, period. March the 29th, we're continuing the interview with Liana Small. I learned a lot about racism when I was going to college because the white professors really weren't used to having intelligent black students. And of course, I went to the best high school in the city, so college was easy for me. I would frequently score the highest mark in the room. And I've set records like in qualitative analysis and organic chemistry. But it's interesting, the teachers in my biology classes where I would get 99s, they would always stand behind me during the exam. And I was saying to myself, what the fuck am I copying from? I was always scoring the highest mark in the room anyway. But, it's interesting. I got 3 C's in college. One was due to an incomplete, which I had talked to earlier about the lab. The other one was due to I got A's in all this philosophy courses, and the final was easy, but I guess the guy didn't want to give black folks A's. I should have actually went back and protested, but I was probably so beaten down with the shit there, I just didn't, did not, but... The other C I got was another easy course, was my first section. My first section of physics. The way University of Detroit worked was you had all these white fraternities and sororities, and they had all the exams, and
the teachers frequently will give the same exams over and over again. I think the physics teacher gave the same exam, and so everyone had the exam, so they ran the curve up so high. But I made sure that didn't happen the next quarter. I got an A in the course. It was actually a very easy course. But when I applied to go to medical school, I applied to... when I graduated, I wasn't really even planning to go to the graduation because I thought the whole thing was a farce. But my mother wanted to see me walk across the stage to see an Aunt Ruth, and I think my father wanted it. So I went just to walk across the stage. They actually took my picture getting my diploma. I think it was because I was a General Motors scholarship. No thanks to General Motors that wanted to kick me out. But I applied to Wayne State, University of Michigan, and Columbia. And when I went to my interview at Wayne State, I told Martin Levin, the assistant dean, that I grew up in the neighborhood right next door. And so his eyes were lit up. And I remember my interview at the University of Michigan. I got in Wayne State, University of Michigan. The guy looked at my card and said, you know, you get all these A's, how'd you happen to get a C's? And rather than go into a long story about, they all thought all black folks were paranoid anyway, all the white folks did, because of racism and the way they treated us. So I just shined it on off and said, well, I did a C, that's what I heard, it was a C, it was obviously a lie, but I didn't want to play into his theories about all black folks being paranoid. I applied to Columbia, and I didn't get in Columbia because I think when I wrote on my application why I was applying to medical school, I said something to the effect that the racism was so prevalent in the United States, I wanted to learn some skills that were useful outside of the United States. So I think that doomed my entry into Columbia's medical school. But I went to Wayne State because I had gotten a General Motors scholarship, Elbert P. Sloan Foundation scholarship, which they gave to the top 10 black students in the United States. Hamilton Holmes, who integrated the University of Georgia, got one of them. And Wayne State told me they were going to give me a scholarship, an O.B. Weed scholarship. I think it was around about $500. So I said, well, I'll be cheaper. I'll go to Wayne State. My parents didn't have a lot of money. This is how I wound up going to Wayne's medical school. At the Wayne's Medical School, I was really, really only two black folks in the class. And what's amazing is the entrance exam, the medical entrance exam, was mostly about culture. It was about opera and classical music and all that stuff, which I was familiar with, but the average black person from the ghetto was not familiar with. And they used to use that exam to weed out, to keep children up. Poor cultures and minorities out of medical school because there were black folks who had C plus averages and B minus B averages who got rejected by Wayne State. Yet when I got there and started talking to my classmates, I was amazed at how many of them had C plus averages and C averages who got in, and all these black folks who had higher averages had to go to Howard and Meharry. Because of they used the cultural-based exam to weed them out, because they didn't ask them about the Supremes or Ray Charles, they asked them about Mozart and Italian opera on the exams. But I had the problem with the entrance exam because I was multicultural from the point of view. I was involved, even though they would never study about black culture. I also was involved in white culture, and I knew about classical music and all that stuff. So it was just it was a piece of cake for me. Besides, I've always was good at taking exams. I was rather when I got to medical school. Martin Levin's first comment to me was, "Well, we may not renew your scholarship." And I just looked at him and said, "Well, if you don't renew it, I'll get the money from Alfred P. Sloan Foundation." I really kind of had a chip on my shoulder because I was tired of dealing with these white folks and racism. And a lot of times a dean would walk up and speak to me, and I didn't feel like speaking to him. I didn't speak back to him.
Why?
And my idea of medical school was to do as little as I could to get out. was very good at cramming. I frequently crammed for exams the night before. And biochemistry, I could always get one of the top marks in the room if I just borrowed someone's notes the night before and memorized them. Couldn't do that with anatomy, but I could pass by cramming for exams. I was not really interested in becoming a very diligent student. I think I got a very bad reputation in the first 2 years because I would frequently be sleeping in the class. I guess they didn't know what to do with me since I was the only black person in the class. It's actually in medical school. My freshman and sophomore year was how I got involved working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We used to work with the Friends of SNCC chapter when I was a freshman in medical school. And that summer, I took a job at Detroit Dodge where my father worked. I think my brother was working there pretty briefly at that time. And actually, I only worked there a couple of weeks. I went to Atlanta with the SNCC people to get away from painting the bottom of the damn trucks. I was such a terrible painter, they put me from painting the sides, spray painting the stars of the truck, to painting the bottom of the truck, so you'd be in the bottom of these damn trucks painting them, and the paint would be falling down on top of you. Anyway, at the time, Mississippi had this project. I went down to Oxford, Ohio that summer. They were organizing the volunteers to go south, and all I remember was John Doerr coming out and speaking and saying, "We can't do nothing to help you folks." So much for the Kennedy's federal government. They could do something to help people in Vietnam, but they couldn't do anything to help their own citizens. But I was there when Rita Swerner found out that her husband had disappeared. Rita Swerner. Mickey Swerner and Andy Goodman, they had left a week earlier, and we all know they were dead. It's ironic that when they were, because there were two white folks involved, the media and the federal government took an interest. Bob Moses knew that as long as black folks were being murdered in Mississippi, no one would care, but if they could get white folks involved, a lot of them were children of congressmen, senators, and prominent people, that murderous brutality faced by black citizens in Mississippi would be dramatized. And ironically, while they were dragging the rivers looking for the bodies of Andrew Goodman and Swerner, all they could find were black bodies of people that had been lynched. George Green, was at Oxford. He was leaving for Mississippi. George, actually, I got to know quite well because my house, while I was in medical school, kind of was a waylay station where a lot of the SNCC workers would stay when they were in Detroit. Crazy George was leaving, and everyone started around saying, "This may be the last time." And George got out of the car and said, "This may be the last time for you, but it ain't gonna be the last time for me." George was working at Macomb County, Mississippi, and said the FBI went and told Foreman, "We can't do nothing to help you. Those guys, they were blowing up about two or three churches down there. It's one of the worst sections." So he said James Foreman gave him his gun when he was going down there because they knew nobody else was going to be able to protect him. George had dropped out of high school to work for SNCC, and like a lot of people, even though nonviolence was the official policy, he believed in self-defense. George had the record. He at one time I had the most arrest of anyone in Mississippi. This is the summer of 64. And so we were looking for, SNCC was looking for people to go to Atlantic City with the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party because they had a vigil. And I volunteered to go. Anything would be working at Dodge's truck, bottom of that damn truck. Come on, Dorothy Dewberry, Frank Joyce, Martha Cozell, and there's another guy from Seattle, a young fellow whose name I've forgotten. So we drove, the chairman of the psychiatry department, his daughter was involved with SNCC. Miss Marilyn, Hank Rogers called her, what was her name? Gottlieb. So we all drove to Atlantic City and spent the week sitting out the damn boardwalk having a vigil. Fannie Lou Hamer came out and talked to us. Martin Luther King came out and talked to us. James Farmer came out and said now that CORE and SNCC were forming a merger. We didn't know anything about no merger, but that was in James Farmer's brain. But Fannie Lou Hamer was a trip. Fannie Lou Hamer, I actually got to know quite well. Her husband was a first cousin to my father's first cousin
by marriage.
And my parents knew her. So when she came to Detroit, we drove around from church to church raising money. We took her to Reverend Franklin's church. Thousands of people there, and he took about four or five collections. He said he was going to split the radio collection with her, and I'm sure he got a fortune. The man knew how to bring money. In fact, on his radio program, he used to have a church in East Oakland, East Detroit, which moved to West Detroit. He was moving to Linwood Avenue. I heard he told his parishioners that only those who prayed and paid him were going to be allowed to move to the new church. Anyway, he was sitting out there with this process here. My father knew him in Memphis because my father used to go to this church in Memphis and told me he knocked up one of the deacon's daughters and had to leave town, so he came to Detroit. Anyway, so he had this big collection. Fannie Lou Hamer gave her a speech, the Freedom Singer sung, and then he gave her $100 as his share of the collection. It's like Louis Farrakhan, who gave this fundraiser for Stokely that kept all the money. Same thing. Or Stokely was happy, at least, let people know that he needed some help. But anyway, we were all sitting out in Atlantic City. Mrs. Hamer came out to talk to us, and she said that they had had an election, and the Hubert Humphrey and their attorney Joe Raw was the attorney for the AFL-CIO. Walter Ruth all told them to accept the compromise. They were going to give them, I think, two seats at large. I think they were even going to be non-voting seats. They were going to seat the Mississippi, the white Mississippians. And they all voted to reject the compromise because they wanted to be representative. In fact, when Mrs. Hamer was such a dramatic speaker, when she was getting ready to speak on national television, Lyndon Johnson didn't want to hear it, so he called a press conference at the same time to cut off anyone hearing her speech. So after the vote, Aaron Henry told Mrs. Hamer that he was going to go out and tell the press that they voted to accept the compromise, even though they had voted unanimously not to accept it. So Mrs. Hamer told him she had a razor blade, and she went out there and told that lie she was going to slit his throat in front of everybody. So he went out and told the truth. There were a couple of educated people in the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. One was Aaron Henry, who was a pharmacist from Jackson, Mississippi. The other one, I believe his name was Ed Bell. He was a minister at Tougaloo. And so they were going to let them have the two seats at large. I guess Aaron wanted his suits. wanted to sit down with the white folks. So we drove back to New York, and actually I wound up staying at Bill Tatum. He had moved to this news house. He was staying on First Avenue, I believe. And so I was staying at his place. And we went over to Stokely's house. Stokely and George and Jim Tripp and myself. Stokely was one of George's old buddies from Greenwood, Mississippi. George Stokely $12 and call the police and there's this drunk Negro on the porch and they're going to arrest
him. Is this Stokely Carmichael?
Yeah, so we figured that Stokely deserved George. George was nuts, so we dropped him off at Stokely's house and told him we'd come back to get him. We left him there. Actually, I was kind of sorry I didn't go back because Stokely and Marion McKeever were relating to each other and they had gave a party that night. And I would have had a chance to meet Marion McKeever. Got to meet Stokely's wife, Stokely's wife's boyfriend. How did I meet Bill Tatum? Well, when I was going to medical school in college, Max Hardeman was a good friend. He ran track, and I used to run track with the, when in high school I would practice with the college guys because there was no competition in high school, and all the college guys, they were running the 440s and 48, and the 100s around 9-8, and I would keep up with them in practice. And so I would never practice, and Max Hardeman had ran track, but he had a stroke and had to stop. And Max lived a couple of blocks from my parents. And Max had went back to New York and went to law school, actually flunked out of law school. So I told him, why don't you go to law school in Detroit? So he came back and went to Wayne State's law school about the same time I was going to medical school. So he was renting out a room. He was renting out the upstairs apartment and sharing it with me when I was in medical. And my parents were charging him like $35 a month for some token to me. It was nothing. My parents were like that. They were always helping somebody out. And Max stayed in Greenwich Village. And I used to go to New York when I was in medical school. And I would always stay at Max's apartment. And Bill Tatum at that time was Max's best friend. They were very involved in the movement in New York. Bill used to go to Lynn Chandler was a folk singer from Detroit. They would go down and take Malcolm X's speeches, and they were involved in the core NAACP chapter in Greenwich Village. And that's how I met Max and Sue.
Bill and Sue.
Sue had this nice apartment building, I recall. It had a white guy in a uniform standing out in front of the apartment building, open the door when you let in. So when we came back from Atlantic City, we actually stayed at, I stayed at Bill's house. Anyway, we dumped George off at Stokely's house and told him we were coming back to the party tonight, but we did. We went to the party uptown with the white folks and just never made it back to Stokely. In fact, we were planning to leave George there. I heard that George got drunk the night before, and Mary McKeever found out that he was one of Stokely's running buddies and wanted to take him out and buy him some clothes and shoes, and George went off on her and started calling her a black bitch. But anyway, we were getting ready to leave go back to Detroit. Going to leave George there, but unfortunately George showed up at the morning we were going to leave. He finally went back to Bill's apartment, so he went back with us. In the summer, between my freshman and sophomore year in medical school. Sophomore year in medical school, I still had the philosophy of doing as little as I could to get through, and I think I upset the pathology department because I used to fall asleep in the labs, and I would try not to go through the biochemistry labs if I could, but I used to always score one of the highest marks on the exam because I could cram the shit in the night before. But I guess I had a not too desirable reputation. Of course, they could make up to you because your easiest part of medical school is your clinical years, your junior, senior years. But all the exams were oral then, and they basically could use that to weed any people out they felt that were undesirable. And I guess they thought I was undesirable in some quarters. gave me incomplete and made me take the national board. So in pathology, so I took it during my junior year. The day I was rotating through surgery, and the day so I took the day off to study, but I think I got an 80 on it. And chief of surgery was South Africa, called me in. It wasn't know how where I was. I told him I was studying for the exam. I noticed during the department surgery that if I showed up 5 minutes late, I would get chewed off, whereas other students would show up 15, 20 minutes late, and nothing would be said to them. And I thought it was just myself he didn't like, because I was always being chewed off. From one of the black first year surgery resident, I just got in trouble because he said something to the effect of how come they were always chewing me off. And when Walt and his students found out about it, they started chewing him out. So he flunked me in surgery and made me repeat it during the summertime, which, and you could basically do whatever you wanted to those, because it's basically the exams were all oral. It was written in oral exam. And I thought maybe he disliked me. I know he brought the chairman of the surgery department over from South Africa to speak to the class once as a surgeon. And he was kind of like the acting chief of surgery, but he wound up being the permanent chief of surgery. Anyway, I later found out from talking to another black physician who came through Wayne's about 10 years after that Walt made his life, so he was from Georgia and actually turned out to be my father's doctor. I believe his name was Willie Williams, something like that. He told me that Walt made his life so unbearable in surgery that he actually had quit the school and flew back to Georgia and said he couldn't take this shit anymore. His brothers and family talked him into going back. I guess Walt was used to apartheid in South Africa and wanted to make a name for himself by bringing apartheid to Wayne State, and I guess he was attempting to be quite successful in doing it. I actually went to Washington twice to pick at the White House while I was in medical school. I remember John Lewis had came to town the week after he had just got beaten up and clubbed in the march from, I think it was from Selma to Montgomery. They go across Edmund Pettus Bridge, so he got knocked unconscious. He and Ivanhoe Donaldson were in town the next week. And so there was a big demonstration in front of the White House. Planned to ensure the safety and actually put pressure on Lyndon Johnson to get his voters' rights law passed. Did Violet Lou, so it actually got killed. She was from Dearborn, Michigan. I went to Washington, D.C. to pick at the White House, and one of my classmates was actually going to go with us, Sherry Bristol, but her father actually showed up at the plane station and pulled him off the train and wouldn't let her go. But I remember there was one crazy lone Nazi in uniform at the in front of the White House. When I got back to school, my colleagues, all they wanted to know was about this Nazi who was standing out there. But you know, in Detroit, we were kind of involved in a lot of organizations. We were involved with the NAACP, which was having Abe Ulmer was having his weekly pickets in the suburbs because black folks couldn't live in the suburbs. We would go out and demonstrate in the suburbs on the weekends. We were involved in the Friends of SNCC chapter. It's just that the feeling was that you not only were gaining an education to help yourself, but the feeling was that you were giving skills that you go back and help the community. at least this was our feeling. Unfortunately, it's not the feeling of most minority students then or now. Anyway, my last senior year in medical school, a very good friend of mine got killed in a car accident. He was a medical student in St. Louis. So I went down, it was rotating through OBGYN. I went down to the funeral and got back. When I got back for the finals time, we took a written exam in OB, which I'm sure I did very well at. I remember the night before, I was getting ready to read about endometriosis. And I just didn't feel like it. I was just worn out and was depressed over losing my friend. So when I had my oral examination, the gynecologist asked me about endometriosis, which of course I hadn't read about. And we were supposed to go to a meeting to get our exams. I didn't go to the meeting. I didn't realize that the guy had bugged me in the oral exam. There was no one bothered to tell me. And I rotated through medicine. Our chief of medicine was a guy from West Germany, Richard Bing. And he apparently at one time used to be a brilliant research doctor, but he was a terrible clinician. He really didn't know anything about practicing medicine, about clinically practicing medicine. But he was from the old school, and if your shoes weren't polished, or you didn't say sir, or didn't have your tie clapped, he'd fuck you to an oral exam. And he gave a series of written questions, which we were supposed to study for an exam, and the exam was basically these written questions. And one of the questions he asked was, did you find that his written questions were useful? And I wrote down that I never looked up any of the answers of the questionnaires, which was a mistake.
Why did you do that?
I didn't give a damn. So he proceeded to flunk me in medicine, so they decided that they were not going to let me graduate and that I was going to have to rotate through OB medicine. And for some reason, surgery, which I'd even passed. But I guess Dr. Walt wanted another crack at me. So I went down to Mississippi and visited my grandparents and came back and told them I'm ready to go. And so they used me as an intern in medicine. And I was actually one of the best interns there. I was as good as any of the other interns. So they didn't even want to give me an exam at the end of the rotation. They didn't feel it was necessary. However, the dean of the medical school called them and said they had to give me an exam. They couldn't do it without giving me an exam. So they called me back a couple of weeks later and told me that we have to give you an exam. We're sorry. So they gave me an oral exam, which first I passed. Then I went through OB, which was really a waste. I would be busy telling the students what questions they should expect on the exam. And after I rotated through OB the second time, they didn't even give me a written exam. They gave me an oral exam, which of course I passed. Then I rotated through surgery again. I was again being used as an intern, basically, and doing all the surgical work. And about 3 weeks, I had 3 weeks left, and I guess I said I got fed up with this shit, so I just walked away. And so I guess Walt sent a letter to all the departments saying that they should not let me graduate because I was, he said that I was immoral and I shouldn't be allowed to graduate from medical school. And they called me in for an interview. I was quite relaxed at the interview, actually. I was very relaxed that there was Dr. Walt, Dr. Levitt, who was the associate dean, Dr. Walt, Dr. Levitt, and Dr. Dean. And they came up and said that, you know, we told you to repeat this the second year, this year, but we think you've just designed the program so you can just finish it. This was around December of that year. So you could, you know, so that you, you know, could design this program so that you could finish it and leave early or something. couldn't do anything about my leaving a surgery because I'd already passed the course already, so there really was no reason for me to rotate through surgery a third time. They had their meeting and then decided I guess they'd better get rid of me since I had no plans of showing up down there anymore. So they sent me a letter saying that you graduated. This was in, they sent me a letter. My last course I took was in November or December. I think I got a letter from them sometime after the holidays telling me to graduate. It's kind of interesting, though. Wayne State did not fill its internship program, and it missed about 20%. No one wanted to intern there because the hospital was filthy, dirty, and they couldn't fill the internship program. And so the guy in charge of the internship program was from, I think, South Carolina or North Carolina. He was a urologist who was just up there for that year. And I went to him for an interview, and I guess he had talked to Dr. Wall. And he said, well, no, you can't start your internship now. We can't start. We're not taking an internship until June. And I talked to, I had planned to go into neurology, and people in neurologists at Harbor Hospital, chief of neurology, like me, I had a very good rotation for neurology, and so he had the radiologist who ran the internship call me up, and they offered me a program there, and the ophthalmology resident was kind of talking me into going into ophthalmology because they didn't have any black students in ophthalmology. But I went out to California trying to see if there were any openings out there. I had one by Harkness Hospital, and they offered me an internship, but there was no. Everyone there had a southern accent and speaking, so I said, I'm not sure if I want to go to Harkness Hospital, which is Southern Pacific. So I gave my